difficult to watch than the route across the Atlantic. Fix didn't remain lost in his thoughts for long. Some sharp blasts on the whistle announced the liner's arrival. The whole horde of porters and fellers rushed towards the quayside, threatening injury and damage to the waiting passengers and their clothes. A dozen or so small boats set off from the bank of the canal and went out to meet the Mongolia. Soon the enormous bulk of the Mongolia came into view, moving along between the banks of the canal. 11 o'clock was striking as the steamer dropped anchor in the harbour, noisily letting steam out of its funnels. There were quite a large number of passengers on board. Some remained on the spar deck, gazing at the picturesque panorama of the town, but most of them disembarked in the small boats that had come alongside the Mongolia. Fix examined closely all those who set foot on dry land. At that moment, one of the passengers came up to him after briskly pushing aside all the fellows who were accosting him and offering their services. He asked Fix very politely if he could point out to him the office of the British consul. At the same time, this passenger showed a passport that he presumably wanted to have stamped with a British visa. Fix instinctively took the passport and rapidly read the description of the bearer. He had difficulty controlling his reaction. The document trembled in his hand. The description provided on the passport was identical to the one he had received from the head of the Metropolitan Police.
"This passport doesn't belong to you, does it?" he said to the passenger.
"No, it's my master's passport."
"And where is your master?"
"Still on board."
"I'm afraid," continued the detective, "he has to go in person to the consul's office to prove his identity."
"What? Is that really necessary?"
"Indispensable."
"So, where is this office?"
"Over there, in the corner of the square," replied the inspector, pointing to a building about 200 yards away.
"In that case, I'll go and fetch my master, who certainly won't be pleased to be disturbed."
With that, the passenger said goodbye to Fix and went back on board the steamer. Chapter 7, which proves once again that passports serve no useful purpose in police matters. The inspector went back down to the quayside and headed off quickly toward the British consulate. As soon as he got there, and at his insistence, he was ushered in to see the consul in person.
"Sir," he said, getting straight to the point, "I have good reason to believe that our man is a passenger on board the Mongolia."
Fix then recounted what had taken place between the servant and himself concerning the passport.
"Well, Mr. Fix," replied the consul, "I'd quite like to see what this crook looks like. But perhaps he won't come to my office if he really is your man. A thief never likes to leave any trace of where he's been, and in any case, it's no longer compulsory to show your passport."
"Sir," replied the detective, "if he's as clever as I think, he will come."
"To have his passport stamped?"
"Yes. All that passports do is inconvenience law-abiding citizens and enable crooks to get away. You can be sure that his will be in order, but I really do hope that you won't stamp it."
"Why on earth not? If this passport is in order," replied the consul, "I'm not in a position to refuse a visa."
"But, sir, it's essential for me to keep him here until I receive the arrest warrant from London."
"Well, Mr. Fix," replied the consul, "that's your business. It's not up to me to..."
The consul was unable to finish his sentence. At that moment, there was a knock on his door, and the office boy showed in two strangers, one of whom was none other than the servant who had spoken to the detective earlier. This time it was the master and his servant. The master showed his passport and asked the consul, in the fewest possible words, to be so kind as to stamp it. The latter took the passport and read it carefully, while Fix, standing in a corner of the room, looked, or rather stared, hard at the stranger. When the consul had finished reading it, he asked,
"Are you Mr. Phileas Fogg?"
"Yes, sir," replied the gentleman.
"And is this man your servant?"
"Yes, a Frenchman called Passepartout."
"Have you come from London?"
"Yes."
And where are you going?
Bombay.
Good, sir. Are you aware that visa formalities are unnecessary and that it is no longer compulsory to show your passport?
I am aware, sir, replied Phileas Fogg, but I want a visa to prove that I've been through Suez.
Very well, sir.
And so the consul signed and dated the passport and then stamped it. Mr. Fogg paid the cost of the visa and, after politely saying goodbye, went out, followed by his servant.
"Well, then?"
asked the inspector.
"Well," replied the consul, "he seems a perfectly law-abiding citizen."
"That's as may be, but it's not the point," replied Fix. "Don't you think that this phlegmatic gentleman looks exactly like the thief I've received the description of?"
"I agree, but, as you know, all descriptions—"
"I want to get to the bottom of this," replied Fix. "I think the servant will be easier to fathom out than his master. What's more, he's French, which means he won't be able to hold his tongue. I'll see you again soon, sir."
With this, the detective went out and began to search for Passepartout. Meanwhile, Mr. Fogg, after leaving the consulate, had headed toward the quayside. There he gave his servant some orders, then got into a small boat that took him to the Mongolia and went back down into his cabin. There he took out his notebook, which contained the following entries. Left London, Wednesday the 2nd of October, 8:45 p.m. Arrived Paris, Thursday the 3rd of October, 7:20 a.m. Left Paris, Thursday, 8:40 a.m. Arrived Turin via Mont-Cenis, Friday 4th of October, 6:35 a.m. Left Turin, Friday 7:20 a.m. Arrived Brindisi, Saturday the 5th of October, 4 p.m. Boarded the Mongolia, Saturday, 5 p.m. Arrived Suez, Wednesday 9th of October, 11 a.m. Total time in hours, 158.5, making 6.5 days. Mr. Fogg had written down these dates on a travel plan laid out in columns, showing, from the 2nd of October to the 21st of December, the month, the day in the month, the day of the week, the estimated time of arrival, and the actual time of arrival for each main staging point. Paris, Brindisi, Suez, Bombay, Calcutta, Singapore, Hong Kong, Yokohama, San Francisco, New York, Liverpool, and London. This enabled him to work out the time gained or lost at each point of his journey. The carefully calculated travel plan thus took account of everything, and Mr. Fogg always knew whether he was ahead or behind schedule. So he wrote in for that day, Wednesday the 9th of October, his arrival in Suez, which, as it coincided with the scheduled time of arrival, was neither a loss nor a gain. Then he had lunch brought to him in his cabin. As for looking around the town, he never even gave it a moment's thought, as he was the sort of Englishman who gets his servant to do the sights for him. Chapter 8, in which Passepartout talks perhaps rather more than he should have. It didn't take Fix long to catch up with Passepartout on the quayside, where the latter was strolling around and observing things, showing none of his master's reluctance to take in the sights.
"Well, my friend," Fix said as he went up to him, "has your passport been stamped?"
"Oh, it's you, sir," the Frenchman replied. "Pleased to meet you. Our papers are all in order."
"Are you looking around the area?"
"Yes, but we are travelling so fast that everything seems a blur. So, now we're in Suez, aren't we?"
"Suez it is.
And that's in Egypt, isn't it?"
"In Egypt, quite right."
"And that's in Africa, isn't it?"
"In Africa."
"In Africa," repeated Passepartout. "I just can't believe it. I tell you what, sir, I didn't expect us to go further than Paris, but I only got to see that wonderful city again between 7:20 and 8:40 in the morning, from the Gare du Nord to the Gare de Lyon. Through the window of a cab and with the rain pouring down. Oh, what a pity. I really wanted to see the Père Lachaise Cemetery again and the circus in the Champs-Élysées."
"So you're in quite a hurry, are you?" asked the inspector.
"Not me, but my master. Incidentally, I must go and buy some socks and shirts. We left without any suitcases, just with an overnight bag.
I can take you to a bazaar where you'll find everything you need.
Sir, replied Passepartout, you really are too kind.
And so the two of them set off. Passepartout kept chatting.
Most of all, he said, I must make sure I don't miss the boat.
You've got time, replied Fix. It's still only midday.
Passepartout took out his big watch.
Midday, he said. Come, Morfitt, it's 9:52.
Your watch is slow, replied Fix.
My watch? A family heirloom from my great-grandfather? It doesn't lose more than 5 minutes in a year. It's as accurate as a chronometer.
I get it, replied Fix. You've kept London time, which is about 2 hours behind Suez. You must be careful to set your watch to the right time in each country.
Me? Alter my watch? Exclaimed Passepartout. Never!
Well, in that case, it won't be in time with the sun.
That's too bad for the sun, sir. It's the sun that'll be wrong.
With that, the dear fellow proudly put his watch back in his waistcoat pocket. A few moments later, Fix said to him,
So, you left London in a rush, did you?
I should say so. Last Wednesday, Mr. Fogg came back from his club at 8 o'clock in the evening, which was quite unlike him, and 3/4 of an hour later, we were on our way.
But where exactly is your master going?
Straight on. He's going around the world.
Around the world? Exclaimed Fix.
Yes, in 80 days. It's for a bet, he says, but between you and me, I don't believe a word of it. It just doesn't make sense. There's something more to it.
Oh, this Mr. Fogg's a bit of an eccentric, is he?
Looks like it.
So he's rich, is he?
Obviously. And he's carrying a tidy sum with him, in fresh banknotes, and he doesn't mind spending it on the way. That's why he's promised the chief engineer of the Mongolia a huge bonus in Bombay if he gets us there with plenty of time to spare.
And you've known your master for quite some time, have you?
What, me?
Replied Passepartout.
I started working for him the day we left.
It is easy to imagine the effect these replies were to have on the already overexcited mind of the police inspector. The sudden departure from London shortly after the theft took place, the large sum of money being carried, the eagerness to arrive in far-off countries, the excuse of an eccentric bet, all these things helped further to confirm Fix's suspicions, as was to be expected. He got the Frenchman to tell him more, and became convinced that this fellow didn't know his master at all, that the latter lived alone in London, that he was thought to be rich, but no one knew where his money came from, that he was an unfathomable individual, etc. But at the same time, Fix felt sure that Phileas Fogg would not disembark at Suez, and that he really was going to Bombay.
"Is Bombay a long way?" asked Passepartout.
"Quite a long way," replied the detective. "It'll take you 10 days or so by sea."
And where exactly is Bombay?
In India.
That's in Asia, isn't it?
Of course.
Heavens above! There's something I've got to tell you. There's something that's been on my mind. It's my lamp.
What lamp?
My gas lamp, which I forgot to switch off and which I'll have to pay the bill for. Well, I've worked out that it'll cost me 2 shillings per day, exactly 6 pence more than I earn. And you can well understand that if the journey goes on...
It is unlikely that Fix understood this business about the gas. He wasn't listening any more, but was deciding what to do next. The Frenchman and he had got to the bazaar. Fix let his companion buy what he needed, urged him not to miss the departure of the Mongolia, and hurried off back to the consul's office. Now that his mind was made up, Fix had fully regained his composure.
"Sir," he said to the consul, "I no longer have the slightest doubt. I've got my man. He passes himself off as an eccentric who's trying to go around the world in 80 days.
So he's cunning, replied the consul. And he's planning to go back to London after throwing all the policemen on two continents off his scent.
That remains to be seen, replied Fix.
Are you sure you're not making a mistake? The consul asked once again.
I'm not making a mistake.
In that case, why was the thief so keen on having his passport stamped to show he's been through Suez?
Why? I've no idea, sir,
the detective replied.
But listen to what I have to say.
And in a few words, he summarized the main points of his conversation with the servant of the said Fogg.
Well, indeed, said the consul. Everything seems to point to this man. So what are you going to do?
Send a telegram to London with an urgent request to send an arrest warrant to Bombay. Then I'll get on board the Mongolia, keep track of my thief all the way to India, and there, on what is British territory, I'll go up to him politely with my warrant in one hand, and I'll put the other on his shoulder to arrest him.
After coldly speaking these words, the detective took his leave of the consul and went to the telegraph office. From there, he sent the head of the Metropolitan Police the telegram already mentioned. A quarter of an hour later, Fix went on board the Mongolia, taking with him some light luggage, but plenty of cash. And soon, the fast-moving steamer was speeding down the Red Sea. Chapter 9. Where the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean prove favorable to Phileas Fogg's purposes. The distance between Suez and Aden is exactly 1,310 nautical miles, and the company's sailing schedule allowed its steamers a period of 138 hours to cover it. The Mongolia, whose engines were at full throttle, was moving fast in order to arrive ahead of schedule. Most of the passengers who had embarked at Brindisi were traveling to India. Some were going to Bombay, others to Calcutta, but via Bombay, because since the opening of the railway that goes right across the subcontinent, it was no longer necessary to go around the tip of Ceylon. Among the passengers were various civil servants and army officers of all ranks. Of the latter, some belonged to the British Army proper, and the others were in charge of native troops or sepoys. All of them received handsome salaries, even now that the British government has taken over the responsibilities and costs of the former East India Company. Second lieutenants get £280 per annum, brigadiers £2,400, and generals £4,000. Life on board the Mongolia was therefore one of luxury, with a society made up of public servants, supplemented by the occasional young English millionaire off to set up a trading post in some far-off part of the empire. The purser, the company's most trusted employee, and the equal of the captain on board, did things in style. At breakfast, lunch at 2 o'clock, dinner at 5:30, and supper at 8 o'clock, the tables groaned under plates of fresh meat and side dishes served up from the ship's meat store and galley. The female passengers, there were some, changed dresses twice a day. There was music and even dancing on board when the state of the sea allowed. But the Red Sea is unpredictable and only too often rough, like all long, narrow gulfs. When the wind was blowing either from the Asiatic or the African side of the coast, the Mongolia, shaped like a long propeller-driven rocket, was caught in the beam and rolled horribly. At such times, the ladies disappeared, the pianos fell silent, and the singing and dancing all stopped. And yet, despite the gale and the swell, the steamer, thanks to its powerful engines, continued on schedule down towards the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb. What was Phileas Fogg doing meanwhile? It might have been thought that he would be worried and anxious all the time, concerned that a change in wind direction might affect the ship's progress, or that a sudden surge of the waves might damage the engines. In a word, that some incident might force the Mongolia to put into port, thereby threatening the success of the journey. Nothing could be further from the truth. Or rather, if the gentleman did think about these possibilities, he didn't let it show.
He was still the same impassive person, the imperturbable member of the Reform Club, impervious to any incident or accident. He showed no more sign of emotion than the ship's chronometers. He rarely put in an appearance on deck. He showed little interest in observing the Red Sea, so full of associations, the scene of the earliest episodes in human history. He didn't come out to view the fascinating towns scattered along its shores, their picturesque outlines occasionally standing out against the horizon. He never even dreamed about the dangers of the Red Sea, which the ancient historians Strabo, Arrian, Artemidorus, and Idrisi always wrote about with awe. Waters that the navigators of old never dared to enter without first making ritual sacrifices to their gods. So what was this eccentric doing, imprisoned as he was on the Mongolia? First of all, he took his 4 daily meals, without the rolling or pitching of the ship ever being able to disturb such a perfectly regulated piece of machinery. Then he played whist. Yes, he had found partners as keen on the game as he was. A tax inspector on the way to his post in Goa, a church minister, the Reverend Decimus Smith, returning to Bombay, and a brigadier general in the British Army who was rejoining his regiment in Benares. These 3 passengers shared Mr. Fogg's passion for whist, and they played it for hours on end, as noiselessly as he did. As for Passepartout, he didn't suffer at all from seasickness. He had a cabin at the fore of the ship, and he, too, took his food seriously. It has to be said that given these conditions, he really enjoyed his trip. He had come to terms with the situation. With good board and lodging, he was seeing the world, and, in any case, he kept telling himself that this whole bizarre episode would come to an end in Bombay. The day after they had left Suez, the 10th of October, Passepartout was on deck when he had the quite pleasant experience of coming across the helpful person to whom he had spoken on arrival in Egypt. "If I am not mistaken," he said, going up to him with his most engaging smile, "it's you, sir, who was so kind as to act as my guide in Suez, isn't it?" "Yes, indeed," replied the detective. "I do recognize you. You are the servant of that eccentric Englishman." "Exactly, Mr.
Fix."
"Mr. Fix," replied Passepartout.
"Delighted to meet up with you again on board. So, where exactly are you going?"
"Well, to Bombay, like you."
"How fortunate! Have you done this trip before?"
"Several times," replied Fix. "I work for P&O.
"So you must know India, then?"
"Well, yes," replied Fix, not wanting to be drawn.
"Is it interesting, India?"
"Very interesting. There are mosques, minarets, temples, fakirs, pagodas, tigers, snakes, dancing girls. But with any luck, you'll have time to look around, won't you?"
"I hope so, Mr. Fix. As you will well understand, a man in his right senses cannot take it upon himself to spend his life going straight from a steamer onto a train and from a train back onto a steamer again just because he's supposed to be going around the world in 80 days. No, this whole performance will come to an end in Bombay. You can take it from me."
"Is Mr. Fogg keeping well?" Fix asked, sounding quite casual.
"Very well, Mr. Fix, and so am I, for that matter. I'm eating like a horse. It's the sea air."
"But I never see your master on deck."
"Never. He's not interested in his surroundings."
"Do you realize, Mr. Passepartout, that this so-called journey in 80 days might well be a cover for some secret mission? A diplomatic mission, for example?"
"Quite honestly, Mr. Fix, I've no idea, I must admit. And when it comes down to it, I couldn't care less."
After this meeting, Passepartout and Fix often chatted together. The police inspector wanted to get to know the servant of this man, Fogg. He might be of use to him at some point. So in the bar of the Mongolia, he often offered to buy him a few glasses of whiskey or pale ale, and the dear fellow accepted them without protest, and even returned the compliment, not to feel indebted to him. He thought that this Fix was, after all, a decent sort of chap. Meanwhile, the ship was making rapid progress. On the 13th of October, Mocha was sighted, surrounded by its ruined walls, above which stood out green date palms. In the distance, toward the mountains, huge fields of coffee plants stretched out. Passepartout was delighted to contemplate this famous town, and he even thought that with its circular walls and its tumble-down fort sticking out like a handle, it looked like a giant-sized coffee cup. In the course of the following night, the Mongolia crossed the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb, whose name means in Arabic, the Gate of Tears, and the next day, 14th of October, it put in at Steamer Point, to the northwest of the harbour at Aden. This was where it was due to take on more fuel. Catering for the fuel needs of steamers when they are so far away from large industrial centres is a serious and important business. Just to take the case of P&O, this represents an annual expenditure of £800,000. It has proved necessary, therefore, to set up depots in several ports, and in these distant parts, coal costs over £3 per ton. The Mongolia still had 1,650 miles to do before reaching Bombay, and it would take 4 hours at Steamer Point for it to refill its coal bunkers. But this hold-up could not have any serious effect whatsoever on Phileas Fogg's timetable. It had been planned. In any case, the Mongolia, instead of arriving in Aden only in the morning of the 15th of October, got there on the evening of the 14th. That meant it was 15 hours ahead of schedule. Mr. Fogg and his servants stepped ashore. The gentleman wanted to have his passport stamped. Fix followed him without being noticed. Once the visa formalities were over, Phileas Fogg went back on board to continue the game of whist he had broken off. Passepartout, for his part, strolled around as usual, mingling with this population of Somalis, Banians, Parsis, Jews, Arabs, and Europeans that make up the 25,000 inhabitants of Aden. He admired the fortifications that make this town the Gibraltar of the Indian Ocean, and the magnificent water tanks that British engineers are still working on 2,000 years after the engineers of King Solomon.
"Fascinating! Really fascinating!"
Passepartout said to himself as he went back on board.
"I realize now that there's a lot to be said for travelling if you want to see something new."
By 6 o'clock in the evening, the Mongolia's propellers were churning up the waters of the harbour of Aden, and soon the ship was in the Indian Ocean. It had a time allocation of 168 hours to complete the crossing from Aden to Bombay. As it happened, conditions in the Indian Ocean were favourable. The winds stayed in the northwest. The sails were used to supplement the ship's steam power. Because it now had more support, the ship rolled less. The women passengers, after another change of clothes, appeared on deck once more. The singing and dancing started up again. And so conditions for the trip were ideal. Passepartout revelled in the pleasant company that fortune had provided for him in the person of Fix. On Sunday, the 20th of October, the coast of India was sighted. 2 hours later, the harbour pilot came aboard the Mongolia. On the horizon, the outline of hills formed a harmonious backdrop. Soon, the rows of palm trees covering the town could be seen standing out clearly. The liner entered the natural harbour formed by the islands of Salsette, Colaba, Elephanta, and Butcher, and by 4:30, it was alongside the quays of Bombay. Phileas Fogg was then in the process of completing the 33rd rubber of the day, and his partner and he, thanks to a bold stroke, had taken all 13 tricks, and so finished this excellent crossing with a magnificent clean sweep. The Mongolia wasn't due to arrive in Bombay until the 22nd of October. In fact, it had arrived on the 20th. This represented, then, a gain of 2 days, which Phileas Fogg methodically entered in the profits column of his travel schedule. Chapter 10, in which Passepartout is only too pleased to get away with losing just a shoe.
As is well known, India, that great upside-down triangle with its base in the north and its apex in the south, has a surface area of 1,400,000 square miles, unevenly populated by 180 million inhabitants. The British government has effective control over a certain part of this immense country. It maintains a Governor-General in Calcutta, governors in Madras, Bombay and Bengal, and a Lieutenant Governor in Agra. But British India proper only accounts for an area of 700,000 square miles and a population of 100 to 110 million. The least that can be said is that a considerable part of the country is still beyond the power of Queen Victoria. It is true to say that in the case of some of the fearsome and terrifying Rajas of the interior, Indian independence is still total. From 1756, the date of the founding of the first British trading post on the site of what is now the city of Madras, up to 1857, the year of the Indian Mutiny, the famous East India Company was all-powerful. It gradually annexed the various provinces, which it purchased from the Rajas in exchange for annuities, which it often failed to pay. It appointed its own Governor-General and all the civilian and military personnel. However, it now no longer exists, and the British possessions in India come under the direct authority of the Crown. For this reason, the physical appearance, the customs, and the ethnographic makeup of the continent tend to vary every day. In the past, travel was by all the ancient forms of transport, by foot, horse, cart, wheelbarrow, palanquin, pick-a-back, coach, etc. Nowadays, steamboats speed up and down the Indus and the Ganges, and thanks to a railway that crosses the whole width of India, with branch lines along its route, the journey from Bombay to Calcutta now only takes 3 days. The route chosen for the railway does not cut across India in a straight line. The distance, as the crow flies, is only between 1,000 and 1,100 miles, and trains travelling at only medium speed would take less than 3 days to cross it. However, this distance is increased by a third, at least, by the detour the railway makes by going up as far as Allahabad in the north of the peninsula. The route taken by the Great Indian Peninsula Railway is roughly as follows. After leaving the island of Bombay, it crosses Salsette, joins the mainland opposite Tanna, crosses the chain of the Western Ghats, runs northeast as far as Burhanpur, travels through the more or less independent territory of Bundelkhand, goes up to Allahabad, turns east to meet the Ganges at Benares, moves slightly away from it and goes back down to the southeast via Burdwan and the French possession of Chandernagore, terminating in Calcutta. It was 4:30 in the afternoon when the passengers from the Mongolia disembarked in Bombay, and the train for Calcutta was leaving at exactly 8:00. Mr. Fogg, therefore, said goodbye to his partners, left the steamboat, gave his servant instructions about what to buy, emphasized the need for him to be at the station before 8:00, and then, walking with the mechanical precision of the seconds hand of an astronomic clock, set off towards the passport office. And so all the marvels of Bombay seemed of no interest to him. The town hall, the magnificent library, the fortifications, the docks, the cotton market, the bazaars, the mosques, the synagogues, the Armenian churches, and the splendid temple on Malabar Hill with its twin polygonal towers. Not for him the masterpieces of Elephanta, with its mysterious underground burial chambers hidden to the southeast of the natural harbour, nor the caves at Kanheri on the island of Salsette, those magnificent remains of Buddhist architecture. Absolutely nothing interested him. When he came out of the passport office, Phileas Fogg went straight to the station, where he took his evening meal. Among other dishes, the head waiter made a point of recommending a fricassee made of jungle rabbit, which he said was delicious. Fogg settled for the fricassee and tasted it scrupulously, but despite the spicy sauce, he found it awful. He summoned the head waiter. "Waiter," he said, looking him straight in the eye, "is this what you call rabbit?"
"Yes, sir,"
the character replied shamelessly.
"Jungle rabbit."
"But didn't this rabbit meow when it was killed?"
"Meow? Oh, sir, it's a rabbit, I swear."
Waiter, Mr. Fogg continued coldly, do not swear, and remember this. In the past, in India, cats were considered sacred animals. Those were the good old days.
For the cats, my lord.
And perhaps for travellers, too. After making his point, Mr. Fogg calmly went back to eating his meal. A few moments after Mr. Fogg, Inspector Fix also disembarked from the Mongolia and hurried off to see the head of the Bombay police. He explained who he was and that he was there to arrest the person suspected of theft. Had they received an arrest warrant from London? They had received nothing. In all fairness, the warrant which had been sent after Fogg had set off could not have arrived yet. Fix was very put out. He wanted to obtain from the police chief an arrest warrant for this man Fogg. The police chief said no. It was a matter for the Metropolitan Police, and only the latter could legally issue a warrant. This sticking to principles and strict adherence to the rule of law is fully in keeping with British traditions, which, in matters of individual freedom, allow no arbitrary exercise of power. Fix didn't press the point and accepted that he would have to wait for his warrant. But he was determined not to let out of his sights this unfathomable scoundrel for as long as the latter remained in Bombay. He was convinced, and, as has been seen, so was Passepartout, that Phileas Fogg would stay on there, thus allowing time for the warrant to arrive. But since the last instructions his master had given him as he left the Mongolia, Passepartout had come to realize the same would be true of Bombay as of Suez and Paris, that this was not the end of his journey, that it would go on at least as far as Calcutta, and probably further. And he began to wonder if Mr. Fogg's bet wasn't for real, and if, when all he wanted was a peaceful life, he wasn't condemned by fate to go around the world in 80 days. Meanwhile, after buying some shirts and pairs of socks, he walked around the streets of Bombay. There was a large crowd of people, and, in the midst of Europeans of various nationalities, Persians with pointed hats, Banyans with round turbans, Sindhis with square hats, Armenians in long robes, and Parsis with black mitres. It was, in fact, the festival celebrated by the Parsis, or Gubres, direct descendants of the followers of Zoroaster, who are the most hard-working, civilized, intelligent, and austere of the Indians, and are the race to which the wealthy native merchants of Bombay currently belong. On that particular day, they were celebrating a sort of religious carnival, with processions and entertainment, which included dancing girls dressed in pink gauze with silver and gold brocade, who moved beautifully, but with great decorum, to the sound of viols and the beating of gongs. It is easy to understand how fascinated Passepartout was by these strange ceremonies, staring at them wide-eyed and listening intently, with a look on his face like that of a complete buffoon. Unfortunately for him and his master, whose journey he threatened to endanger, his curiosity led him further afield than was sensible. What happened was that after catching sight of the Parsi carnival, Passepartout was heading towards the station when, as he passed in front of the wonderful temple on Malabar Hill, he had the foolish idea of going inside to have a look. He was unaware of two things. Firstly, that entry into certain temples is strictly forbidden to Christians, and secondly, that even believers can only enter after leaving their shoes at the entrance. It should be noted here that the British government has adopted the eminently sensible policy of respecting and enforcing down to the smallest detail the religious observances of the country, and punishes severely anyone who violates them. Passepartout, who had gone in without malice, like a mere tourist, was admiring inside Malabar Hill the dazzling but fussy detail of Hindu ornamentation, when suddenly he was knocked to the floor in this holy place. Three priests, their eyes blazing with anger, rushed at him, tore off his shoes and his socks, and began to beat him soundly, shouting wildly as they did so. The Frenchman, who was strong and agile, quickly got back on his feet and knocked to the ground two of his opponents, who were hampered by their long robes. Then, rushing out of the temple as fast as his legs could carry him, he soon outdistanced the third Hindu, who had set off in hot pursuit of him after alerting the local population. At 8:05, only a few minutes before the train was due to leave, Passepartout arrived at the railway station. He was without his hat, had nothing on his feet, and had lost in the struggle the package containing everything he had bought. Fix was there on the departure platform. After following that man Fogg to the station, he had realized that the scoundrel was going to leave Bombay. He had immediately made up his mind to accompany him as far as Calcutta, and beyond if necessary. Passepartout did not see Fix, who was standing in the shadows, but Fix overheard Passepartout's brief account of his adventures, which he gave to his master. "I trust there'll be no repetition of this," was all that Phileas Fogg replied as he sat down in one of the train carriages. Barefoot and crestfallen, the poor fellow followed his master without saying a word. Fix was about to get into a separate carriage when a thought occurred to him that suddenly made him change his plan to leave.
"No, I'm staying," he said to himself. "An offence committed on Indian soil? I've got my man."
At that moment, the locomotive let out a loud whistle, and the train disappeared into the night. Chapter 11, in which Phileas Fogg pays a phenomenal price for a means of transport. The train had left at the scheduled time. It was carrying a fair number of passengers, including some officers, civil servants, and traders in opium and indigo who were travelling to the eastern part of the subcontinent on business. Passepartout was in the same carriage as his master. A third traveller had taken his seat in the opposite corner. It was Brigadier General Sir Francis Cromartie, one of Mr. Fogg's whist partners during the crossing from Suez to Bombay, who was rejoining his troops stationed near Benares. Sir Francis Cromartie was a tall, fair-haired man, aged about 50, who had distinguished himself in action during the last sepoy revolt and could justifiably be considered a native. He had lived in India since his youth and had made only occasional visits to the country of his birth. He was a well-educated man who would have been pleased to give information about the customs, history, and administration of India if Phileas Fogg had been the sort who would have asked for it. But the English gentleman asked nothing. He was not travelling, he was tracing a circle. He was matter in orbit around the globe, following the laws of physics. At this moment in time, he was working out in his head the number of hours spent since leaving London, and he would have rubbed his hands had it been in his nature to make an unnecessary movement. Sir Francis Cromartie was perfectly aware of the eccentricity of his travelling companion, even though he had only had time to study him while playing cards between two rubbers. He was quite justified, therefore, in wondering whether a human heart did lie beneath this cold exterior, whether Phileas Fogg had any conception of the beauty of nature or any moral aspirations. There had to be some doubt about that. Of all the odd sorts the Brigadier General had met, none of them could stand comparison with this product of the exact sciences. Phileas Fogg had made no effort to conceal from Sir Francis Cromartie his plan of travelling around the world, nor how he intended to carry it out. The Brigadier General considered this bet to be just another example of pointless eccentricity, inevitably lacking in the principle of transire beneficiendo, that should guide the actions of all reasonable people. At the rate this odd gentleman was going, he was likely to pass through life without doing anything positive, either for himself or for others. 1 hour after leaving Bombay, the train had crossed the island of Salsette over a series of viaducts and was speeding along the mainland. At Kalyan Station, it left behind to its right the branch line that went down via Kandala and Pune to the southeast of India and reached Panwell Station. At this point, it entered the extensive mountain range of the Western Ghats, a formation of trap rock and basalt, whose highest summits are densely wooded. From time to time, Sir Francis Cromartie and Phileas Fogg exchanged a few words, and at one point the Brigadier General attempted to revive the flagging conversation.
A few years ago, Mr. Fogg, you would have suffered a delay at this stage that would probably have jeopardized your whole journey.
And why is that, Sir Francis?
Because the railway stopped at the foot of these mountains, and they had to be crossed in a palanquin or by pony as far as Kandala Station on the other side of the mountains.
This delay would not have disrupted in the least the organization of my timetable, replied Mr. Fogg. I have been careful to take into account the possibility of encountering certain obstacles.
Nevertheless, Mr. Fogg, continued the Brigadier General, you could have had a serious problem on your hands with the business involving this man of yours.
Passepartout, whose feet were tangled up in his travel rug, was fast asleep, oblivious of the fact that they were talking about him.
The British government takes a very serious view, and rightly so, of this kind of offence,
Sir Francis Cromarty went on.
It is particularly anxious to respect the religious practices of India, and if your servant had been caught...
Well, if he'd been caught, Sir Francis, replied Mr. Fogg,
he would have been convicted, he would have served his sentence, and then would have returned quietly to Europe.
I fail to see how this business could have delayed his master. With that, the conversation came to an end. During the night, the train crossed the Ghats, went through Nasik, and the following day, 21st of October, sped across the relatively flat landscape of Kandesh. The countryside was well cultivated and dotted with small towns, in which the towers of temples replaced the steeples of European churches. Numerous small rivers, most of them tributaries or sub-tributaries of the Godavari, irrigated this fertile land. When he awoke, Passepartout saw, to his amazement, that he was crossing the Indian subcontinent in a train belonging to the Great Peninsula Railway. He couldn't believe it, and yet it really was true. The locomotive, driven by an English engine man and fueled by English coal, poured out its smoke over plantations of cotton, coffee, nutmeg, cloves, and red pepper. The steam spiraled up over clumps of palm trees, between which could be seen picturesque bungalows, a few viharas, or monasteries, now in ruins, and some wonderful temples decorated with the inexhaustible richness of detail of Indian architecture. Then there were huge expanses of land stretching as far as the eye could see. Jungles teeming with snakes and tigers, frightened by the rushing of the train, and finally forests that the route of the railway had sliced through, but was still the haunt of elephants, which looked on thoughtfully as the convoy swept breathlessly by. That morning, beyond the station at Malagaon, the travellers went through the forbidding area that was so often the scene of bloody crimes committed by the votaries of the goddess Kali. Not far away, they could see Ellora and its wonderful temples, and also the famous city of Aurangabad, once the fearsome Aurangzeb's capital city, but now merely an administrative town in one of the isolated provinces of the Nizam of Hyderabad's dominions. This was the area that used to be controlled by Feringhea, the chief of the thugs, the king of the stranglers. These assassins, who had banded together in an organization that lay beyond the reach of the law, strangled their victims, whatever their age, in honor of the goddess of death, without ever shedding blood. And there was a time when it was impossible to dig below the surface of the soil without finding a dead body. The British government has, it is true, succeeded in reducing the number of murders, but this terrifying organization still exists and continues to operate. At 12:30, the train stopped in the station of Burhampur, and Passepartout was able to buy, though at considerable expense, a pair of Oriental slippers decorated with imitation pearls, which he put on with no attempt to disguise his vanity. The travellers had a quick lunch and set off again for Asogur Station, after following for a short time the course of the Tapi, a small river that enters the Gulf of Cambay near Surat. It is worth explaining at this point the thoughts that were going through Passepartout's mind. Up until his arrival in Bombay, he had believed quite reasonably that that was as far as things would go. But now, since he had been speeding across India, he had undergone a change of mind. His natural instincts had returned with a vengeance. he rediscovered all the fanciful ideas of his younger days. He took his master's plans seriously. He believed that the bet was for real, as were the journey around the world and the maximum number of days that they mustn't exceed. Already, even he was worrying about possible delays and accidents that might occur on the way. He felt caught up in this bet and trembled at the thought that he might have jeopardized it the previous day by the unforgivable way he had wandered off sightseeing. Therefore, being much less phlegmatic than Mr. Fogg, he was much more anxious. He counted over and over the days that had gone, cursing the train every time it halted, accusing it of being too slow, and inwardly criticizing Mr. Fogg for not having offered the driver a reward. The dear fellow did not realize that what was possible on a steamboat was not possible on a railway, where the speed is regulated. Towards the evening, the train entered the passes through the Satpura Hills, which separate the territory of Khandesh from that of Bundelkhand. The next day, 22nd of October, in reply to a question from Sir Francis Cromartie, Passepartout had looked at his watch and answered that it was 3 o'clock in the morning. And it is true, this famous watch, still set to the Greenwich Meridian, which was almost 77 degrees to the west, should have been, and in fact was, 4 hours slow. Sir Francis therefore corrected the time Passepartout had given him and made the same comment to him as Fix had done. He tried to explain to him that he should set his watch according to each new meridian and that, as he was going eastwards, that is, towards the sun, the days became shorter by 4 minutes with each degree passed. It was futile. Whether the stubborn fellow understood or not the Brigadier General's remark, he solemnly refused to put his watch forward, leaving it permanently on London time. In any case, it was an innocent fixation which couldn't harm anyone. At 8 o'clock in the morning and 15 miles from the station at Rothal, the train stopped in the middle of a vast clearing, around which were a few bungalows and workers' huts. The guard of the train went along the carriages, saying, "Passengers should alight here." Phileas Fogg looked at Sir Francis Cromartie, who seemed puzzled by this stop in the middle of a forest of tamarisks and cajuput trees. Passepartout was no less surprised and rushed out along the track, but came back almost immediately shouting, "Sir, the railway's come to an end."
"What do you mean?" asked Sir Francis Cromartie.
"I mean, the train can't go any further."
The Brigadier General immediately got out of the carriage. Phileas Fogg followed him, but in no hurry. Both of them turned to the guard.
"Where are we?"
said Sir Francis Cromartie.
"In the hamlet of Colby," replied the guard.
"Are we stopping here?"
"I assume so. The railway line isn't finished."
"What? It isn't finished?"
"No, there's still a section of about 50 miles to complete between here and Allahabad, where the line continues."
"But the newspapers said the railway had been completed."
"What can I say, sir? The newspapers are wrong."
"And yet you still make out the tickets from Bombay to Calcutta?"
continued Sir Francis, who was beginning to get angry.
"Certainly,"
replied the guard.
"But passengers are fully aware that they need to find another means of transport from Colby to Allahabad."
Sir Francis Cromartie was furious. Passepartout would have cheerfully assaulted the guard, though it really wasn't his fault. He didn't dare look at his master.
"Sir Francis," Mr. Fogg said simply, "we shall, if you agree, decide upon a way of getting to Allahabad."
"Mr. Fogg, this is a delay that is extremely prejudicial to your interests, is it not?"
"No, Sir Francis, this had been taken into account."
"What? You knew that the line—"
"Not at all. But I did know that some obstacle or other would crop up sooner or later on my route. In fact, nothing is in jeopardy. I have 2 days spare that I can use. There's a steamer that leaves Calcutta for Hong Kong on the 25th at midday. Today is only the 22nd, and we shall get to Calcutta on time."
There was nothing that could be said in reply to such a categorical statement. It was only too true that the building of the railway had stopped at this point. Newspapers are like certain watches that insist on being fast, and they had prematurely announced the completion of the line. Most of the passengers knew that the line was not finished, and when they got out of the train they had taken possession of every type of vehicle available in this small town. Four-wheel palki garis, carts pulled by zebus, a sort of buffalo with a hump, carriages that looked like mobile temples, palanquins, ponies, etc. The result was that Mr. Fogg and Sir Francis Cromarty, after scouring the whole town, returned empty-handed. "I shall go on foot," said Phileas Fogg. Passepartout, who at this point met up with his master, winced knowingly as he looked down at his magnificent but impractical slippers. Very fortunately, he had also been casting around for a solution, and he said, rather hesitantly,
"Sir, I think I've found a means of transport."
"What sort?"
"An elephant. An elephant belonging to an Indian who lives only 100 yards from here."
"Let's go and see the elephant," replied Mr. Fogg. 5 minutes later, Phileas Fogg, Sir Francis Cromarty, and Passepartout arrived at a hut adjoining an enclosure surrounded by a high fence. In the hut was an Indian, and in the enclosure, an elephant. As requested, the Indian let Mr. Fogg and his two companions into the enclosure. There they came upon an animal that was half-tamed, which his master was rearing, not as a beast of burden, but for combat. With this aim in mind, he had begun to change the animal's naturally gentle temperament in order to arouse him gradually to a state of excitement and frenzy, which the Indians call must. And to do this, he fed him for 3 months with sugar and butter. This treatment may seem inappropriate for the intended result, but it was nonetheless employed successfully by elephant trainers. Very fortunately for Mr. Fogg, the elephant in question had only just been put on this diet and had not yet reached a state of must. Kayuni, this was the animal's name, was capable, like all members of its species, of walking long distances at considerable speed, and in the absence of another means of transport, Phileas Fogg decided to use him. Elephants are, however, expensive in India, as they are becoming rare. The males, the only ones that can be used in circus acts, are highly sought after. These animals rarely reproduce in captivity, with the result that they can only be obtained by being captured in the wild. They are therefore looked after with great care, and when Mr. Fogg asked the Indian if he could hire his elephant, the Indian refused categorically. Fogg persisted and offered too high a price for the beast, £10 an hour. No. £20. No again. £40. Still no. Passepartout was more and more horrified as the price offered went up, but the Indian would not give in. It was a considerable amount of money, though. Assuming that it would take 15 hours for the animal to get to Allahabad, that was £600 that it would make for its owner. Without betraying the least sign of emotion, Phileas Fogg then made the Indian a proposal to buy his beast, offering him, first of all, £1,000. The Indian didn't want to sell. Perhaps the cunning fellow had sensed he could make a very good deal. Sir Francis Cromarty took Mr. Fogg aside and urged him to think carefully before going any further. Phileas Fogg replied to his companion that it was not in his habit to act without careful thought, that what was at stake was a bet of £20,000, that this elephant was vital for him, and that, even if he had to pay 20 times its value, he would have the animal. Mr. Fogg went back to the Indian, whose little eyes had lit up with greed. Proof that for him all that mattered was the price. Phileas Fogg offered successively £1,200, then £1,500, then £1,800, and finally £2,000. Passepartout, who had such a ruddy complexion normally, was white as a sheet. At £2,000, the Indian gave in.
"Bless my slippers!" exclaimed Passepartout. "That's an expensive price for a piece of elephant meat."
The deal was done, and all that was left was to find a guide. This proved easier. A young, intelligent-looking Parsi offered his services. Mr. Fogg agreed and promised him a considerable sum of money in return, a sure way of stimulating his intelligence even further. The elephant was led in and got ready without delay. The Parsi knew the job of the mahout, or elephant driver, inside out. He covered the elephant's back with a sort of saddle cloth and set up one on each side of the animal.